Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Mountain with lots to do. Give me the sunshine, give me a dew. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain dew. So give me my good friends, give me a dew.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
Memorial Day means serious savings at Sleep Outfitters. Save up to $1,500 store-wide. Tempur-Pedic and Sealy adjustable sets are now up to $500 off. Or get a king purple mattress for the price of a queen. Plus, free next-day delivery and setup. And our exclusive lifetime price guarantee locks in your best price forever. The Sleep Outfitters Memorial Day Sale, going on now. You don't want to miss it. Only at Sleep Outfitters.
Hi, it's Bill and Jenny with Simple Bath and Kitchen. Columbus teachers, thank you. You give your all during the school year.
So when summer break comes, your home should give something back to you. Imagine starting your school year with a brand new kitchen or spa-like bathroom.
The key? Getting started now, so your project is completed while you're off this summer. At Simple Bath and Kitchen, we'll guide you every step of the way with quality craftsmanship, clear timelines, and a process built around your schedule.
Visit us today at simplebathandkitchen.com to set up your free, no-pressure estimate. We make it simple for you.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to another episode of The Interviews, the spin-off show that chronicles cracking chats with the cream of the cinematic crop. And this week, we're inundated with legends. First up is the most successful director of all time. No, not Brian LeFant, the director of Problem Child 2 and Jingle All the Way. It's James Cameron, director of all three Avatar movies, of course, plus Titanic, True Lies, Terminator 1 and 2, Aliens, our current cover movie, and The Abyss. Not a bad little lot, that. He's directed also some documentaries in his time, but he's never ventured as far outside his comfort zone as he has with his latest movie, Billie Eilish, Hit Me Hard and Soft, The Tour, live in 3D, which is a concert movie, and you'll never guess who the subject is. In fact, Billie Eilish isn't just the subject, but the film's co-director, and it is a mesmerizing audiovisual depiction of her gigs at the Co-op Live Arena in Manchester last year, and features Cameron deploying his mastery of 3D to scintillating effect to bring it to life. And when he and Eilish came into London last week, we jumped at the chance to talk to them both, and that conversation with Alex Godfrey can be heard over on the main Empire podcast. But I was also offered the chance to sit down for a one-on-one with Cameron to talk about the tech he had developed and progressed for this movie, and well, you just don't say no to an offer like that. But as ever, with James Cameron, we found ourselves talking about a lot more besides. So here it is, James Francis Cameron, who prefers to be called Jim, talking to Christopher Thomas Ambrose Hewitt, who prefers to be called Chris. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the great James Cameron. How are you, sir?
Hey, good, good. Is this thing on?
This yep. is okay. on. Although if I can send this to you and you can fix it in post, right?
we can fix it in post. We'll just do AI and just fake, you know, just synthesize all my answers.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that. Because this is a daunting task for me, Jim, because I'm about to talk tech with you.
That's all right.
And
I can handle it.
You are James Cameron.
Thank
and
you. Thank
I am
you for
a copper-plated idiot.
All right, we'll break it down. We'll break it down and simplify it. No, something tells me you know what you're talking about.
A little bit, but to quote Jeremy Irons in Margin Call, speak to me as you would a small child or a golden retriever. But the tech on display in this movie is astonishing. At one point, I was looking for camera people on the stage, and there is one.
Yeah.
Coal.
Yeah.
There is also the Billy cam that Billy picks up at various
and
points.
Both of those are the most subjective moments, yes. I think, of her performance. Obviously, when she's filming herself with the Billy cam, you're inches from her face, and she knows how to do that. But I think by the time we shot that, the four nights in Manchester, she'd already done about 70 or 80 shows. So she had that dialed in. I've told her, you know, if she wants, if the music thing doesn't work out, she can always come work for me as a camera operator, you know, and there's something quite magical about that, the subjectivity of it, you know, and the way she celebrates her band and connects with the audience and everybody through an actual camera that she's operating.
Yeah.
And that was all built in. I didn't suggest any of that stuff. I would have loved to have been that brilliant to suggest it, but it was already part of the show and something she had created. The problem for us was that we looked at creating a 3D native stereo alternative for the Billy cam. At the last second, we just said, look, we don't want to shift the weight and balance or the form factor of that thing by 1%. We don't want to compromise her performance of that. So we decided to do conversion.
And
we worked with a company that uses some AI in their process for conversion, and they did a great job, a company called The Outsiders. And I was very happy with the outcome on that, because the thing there was just get it the way she does it, and then we'll manipulate the image later.
Now,
on the other hand, when we were on stage with her with our gimbal camera, which is about 25% of the film, so a significant portion, that was two little tiny cameras that added up to a space about the size of half a cigarette pack. This is true. And we're shooting 4K and blowing it up. We did a little bit of post-work on the image using AI upscale to sharpen it and make it crystal clear. But we got amazing results from that little camera. The thing was, Billy didn't want anybody on stage with her.
Yes.
Anybody that, you know, because she moves like a jackrabbit.
Yeah.
And she pivots, and we knew we weren't going to have time for rehearsal. I finally was able to talk her into letting this young operator, Cole, same age as her.
Yeah,
you know, I think she was 23 at the time; he was 22, who was already on stage with her on one song. I can't remember which song it was. I think it was "Birds of a Feather."
Okay,
and he was already on stage with her, so they had already been sort of dancing throughout the whole tour to date, but it was only on one song, and there were 28 other songs. I said, all right, can we get Cole on with you in some of the other songs? And eventually, you know, I just kept unchilling until we finally got Cole on stage with her for every single song. And then the way we did it was, it just wasn't every single song every single night. We'd hopscotch around so that he'd do a few songs each night. And the poor guy had no rehearsal. I mean, there was no choreography, no rehearsal whatsoever. He was going entirely on my broad instructions before the show and his instinct. And he did some things instinctively that are genius, absolute genius. I think a lot of the power of the film is because he got right in there with her. You know, he sometimes got within minimum focus, and it was okay. It doesn't matter, because you're right there with her when she's doing her thing at the peak of Wildflower, for example, and he's arcing around her, and you see 16,000 or 20,000 people with their phone lights on, looking like this incredible, you know, array of candles, it almost feels like, right? Because of the warmth of the color. And he's arcing around her, and it's just not too fast, not too slow. It's just, I mean, he hit a sweet spot that was kind of amazing. I mean, I'd love to say I'd love to take credit for it, but I wasn't in his ear in real time, because I didn't want to be on their channel messing with their show that was so tightly choreographed.
I was going to ask, where were you? Because you were operating cameras. There's a moment towards the end of the film where we hear you talking to someone in the audience.
I operated only in the behind the scenes. During the actual show proper, we rehearsed the hell out of everything to the extent that we could during sound check and placed all our cameras. But I was calling it from a monitor station where I had 17 feeds. And I'm looking at the stereo, and we were adjusting the stereo and adjusting the framing from there.
Are you fission mixing in real time almost?
I wasn't doing a line cut, but I was doing a line cut in my head.
Okay.
So I'm looking at it. Okay, I love that shot. Boom. Where do I have to go next? Boom. And then if it landed, if they were like moving or something, then I knew I didn't have the cut that I wanted. And then we'd work on that the next night. But, we went in with a really strong team. We had 17 cameras. We had cable cam. We moved the cable cam because she's playing it in the round, and so she's playing to all four quadrants. So we moved the cable cam every single day to a new position.
Okay.
So nobody ever got any real rehearsal. You know, the cable cam guys were just, we think this is working. They were a great team as well. They were out of Germany. Those guys had incredible instincts.
And this was something that you did,
I did not ask permission. I did not inform Disney that I was leaving, the highest costing film they'd ever made in their lives at the most critical moment of post-production, editing the film and finishing the effects. And I just left. All right, see you guys.
Long weekend in Manchester.
Took off for whatever it was, 10 days, and made this film. And then took off again a little later in November because we batted cleanup in Phoenix.
Yes.
And then we literally just freely mixed those shots in the final edit.
So you snuck away. You played truant, and you had this incredibly invigorating creative process shooting this. Did that inform... Fire and Ash, will it inform what you're doing?
No, not at all. Because Fire and Ash was shot.
It was done.
At that point in August, you got to remember where we are is we're mixing.
Yeah.
So all of the VFX turnovers have gone in 6 or 8 months earlier.
Yeah.
So we're finishing. At that point, we still probably had about 1,000 shots to finish, which only sounds big until you realize there's 3,500 shots in the whole movie.
So you're over the crest.
Right.
Of the hill.
So 1,000 shots is like, okay, we're right on track here. And we're mixing the film. And since I hadn't mixed the Billy film yet, that mixing process didn't inform what I was doing. I would say it's more the other way around. The Avatar mixes are very complex mixes and, mm-hmm. The music is a big part of that, and I asked my composer Simon Franklin to deliver to me a lot of flexibility in terms of the way he delivers the tracks. So he'll deliver a couple hundred tracks for one cue, right? So we can contour it and shape it to the scene and bob and weave around the sound effects and the sound design, and so when I went into the Billy mix, we had her album mixer with us, Aaron. Mm-hmm. And so we had a lot of flexibility there. But they had also recorded crowd mics. They call them crowd mics.
Yeah.
But they had a lot of audience mics around. And so we had a lot of flexibility spatially in how we could layer the audience in. Because, I had realized early on that the audience is a main character here. Billy's the main character. The audience is the next most important character. And her interaction, her interplay with them, she does a kind of call response thing. They're also mm-hmm. always singing. Mm-hmm. She gives them space to enter in on many of the songs, and they know their cues. Mm-hmm. It's almost a combined performance in many ways.
Yeah, those moments when she's reaching out to the audience and it feels like almost like a beatific moment where mm-hmm. she's almost being anointed as a saint or a god by them and reaching out en masse.
It's very reverential, but you realize that it's coming from a deep emotional and psychological place for them.
Yeah.
When you really drill down, it's not just a frothy pulp culture phenomenon. She has grown up with them. They've watched her go through the trials and tribulations of her anxious teenage years and emerge this confident, powerful woman, and that means so much to them. And you see it when we interviewed them. You see their vulnerability. You see how at risk some of them are, whether it's gender identity, other identity issues, bullying, whatever it is. These kids, she's been a beacon for them. And once you start to realize that, that to me is when the movie becomes more emotional. You see their emotion early on, and I almost would think, you know, just coming in, not knowing her and her world, I would almost think, okay, this is a little over the top, you know, and then you realize it's not, that it's highly, highly meaningful for them. And it's highly meaningful for her to get that resonance back from them, you know, and I think, I don't want to speak for Billy. My impression is she's not sort of consciously wanting to be a role model, but she accepts the fact that by bearing her soul and her vulnerability, she becomes a kind of a leader, an emotional leader for them, even if she's just willing to go into the fire first.
This tech that you use, because you have got 34 cameras studded around the co-op arena in Manchester. Was this technology, the cameras you referred to earlier on, the ones that are as light as a cigarette packet, if not lighter?
Yeah, we got the little cameras, and then we've got these monster cameras that were able to reach out and get good stereo space at her at a range of 150 or 200 feet.
Which is astonishing.
And that's also a breakthrough, because typically when you reach out with really long telephoto lenses, it just flattens everything. Everything looks like a cardboard cutout.
Yeah.
I said, we're not doing that. If the only way for us to get these beautiful close-ups is from that far back, we're going to do something we've never done before. And so we push the baseline out between the lenses out to somewhere around anywhere between 16 and 22 inches. And what that does is it creates a nice roundness and a fullness at her, and it completely destroys the background to where it's absolutely unfusible by the human eye. So I said, now we're going to use artificial intelligence, generative AI, to segment her out and to slip the background to itself and to make up missing background. And we're going to reconstruct that so that it's fusible to the eye. We're going to intentionally make terrible stereo to make a beautiful foreground, and then we're going to fix it. And that's what we did. We did a test and we proved the principle. And then we went out there with these giant guns to make beautiful 3D on her at an impossible range. Because there was no other way to get those gorgeous close-ups.
Wow.
And was that- so, you know, we were using a lot of cutting edge. We had the Agito cameras, which are unmanned robotic platforms that are running around in the aisleway or all the way around the stage. We had four of those. We had a couple more of them up in the audience that were running back and forth behind the very back row in the bleachers. So we had six robotic camera positions. We had the tower cams, which are also remotely operated. We had the cable cam. We had the on-stage gimbal camera with her, which is what gives you that real sense of being there with her on stage. And then we had these, you know, I call them the big guns, the hyper stereo cameras. So we were just fielding every new trick we knew to get in there and to create that experience.
And was this stuff you were developing anyway, or did you work on it more specifically for this?
Little of both. The hyper stereo system was built entirely for the Billy show, because once we got a look at how it was going to work, we knew we were not going to be able to get a camera right there in front of her.
And this is months, Jim. You got months to do this, right?
We had less than 2 months.
Jesus.
Yeah. So it was full tilt. It was full tilt in our engineering department.
It's pretty damn impressive.
I'm very pleased with the outcome technically.
The intimacy is incredible.
I love the movie cinematically. I love her. You know, I just love what she does. She's so amazing as a performer. You know, I have to say that my respect has built sort of continuously and linearly in an upward sloping curve across this entire project until today. Now I get the added benefit of she and I are pals now. You know what I mean? We went through the fire together. I don't want to say we fought like cats and dogs, but we did butt heads, as you'd expect in a creative collaboration between two, you know, kind of willful, visionary people. I always assured her from the beginning that I would never assert my authority. I would only advocate for certain things if we disagreed, and I would give her a chance to, I asked her to give me a chance to hear me out. Uh-huh. And if she still believed strongly it had to be that way, then it was going to be that way, her way, because it had to be.
Right? You're coming into her world.
It's her face, it's her music, it's her show.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't an Avatar film. You know, I told her, you know, you ever want to show up and act in an Avatar movie? It's going to be a whole different deal, lady.
No Billy Cam is in the Avatar world.
You know, Billy Cam is pretty great. You got to admit. And when she does Bad amazing. Boy and she's talking to the lands and she's taunting this poor person's girlfriend, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I'm only good at being bad, you know?
I've got to let you go, but are you planning to use this technology that you have developed for this in something else going forward?
We'll apply it broadly. We can now, I feel confident, you know, we could shoot soccer, we can shoot American football, we could shoot basketball, we could shoot the Olympics. We've got all the tools we need now to be, you know, to be close, to be fast, to be mobile, and to be far back, but creating good stereo. We could do it all.
A soccer game would be interesting.
Yeah.
That'd be very interesting.
Hell yeah.
World Cup's in just a couple of months. You can work at the same rate you did for this.
I don't have my team here. Sorry.
Well, luckily they're going to be over there. But, you know, we'll figure it out.
But you can see what the stereo adds to the experience, right? There's everybody always thinks that the spectacle is augmented and that's where stereo lives and breathes. I think that it's the close, intimate stuff. When you're in the crowd and their heads and their hands are right in front of you and you see her reaching down to you to touch hands, you feel like you're right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's really an enhanced sense of presence. And then I think that in turn enhances your emotional connection.
In terms of the technology moving forward, are you planning to do something with Avatar going forward with this technology that you've developed?
Well, look, I mean, that's a given, right? Yeah. In my world, we're constantly trying to improve everything at in every part of it, whether it's in the animation workflow, in the CG workflow, in the live action, you know, photographic capture. You know, I'm always trying to make it better, trying to make it a better experience for the audience. And in the presentation, right? We need better light levels in the theaters. If you saw it, you know, you saw it here in our kind of laboratory conditions, right? It won't be that bright in a lot of theaters.
If I'm a pain punter this weekend or next weekend.
If you're a pain punter this weekend, you're not going to see it that bright. And you probably won't hear it that loud. No. I've already asked Billy if she'll appeal to her fans on social to go, every single one of them, all 150 million of them, go to the theater manager and complain and turn that shit up, people, you know.
This could be if 150 million people go see this thing, this could be a contender to your movie.
That's a good problem to have.
That's a very, very good problem to have. What is next for you? Because I know that you've mentioned in the past that you might take a break before the next Avatar film.
I'm unemployed.
You might do something else.
We've got an American premiere of you know, Hit Me Hard and Soft in a few days, and after that, I'm like Roadrunner going off a cliff. You know, I'll be doing some writing. I've got a number of projects that I'm cooking.
Yes.
You know, and Avatar 4 and 5 are still floating out there. We're going to be looking at some new technologies to try to do them more efficiently.
Okay.
Because they're hideously expensive and take a long time. I want to do them in half the time for 2/3 of the cost. That's my metric. And so it's going to take us a year or so to figure out how to do that.
Uh-huh.
And in the meantime, I'll be writing and probably doing a couple of other things.
Amazing. So when you say you're unemployed, I mean, I do need someone to help me with the editing of this podcast, Jim. Are you available? What's your day rate?
It's really more of kind of a show rate, you know, for the whole thing. You got to kind of buy the whole thing. You know, I don't do piecework.
Okay. I think somehow you would bankrupt the Empire podcast.
Not necessarily.
No?
No, Robert Rodriguez and I are talking about doing something that's so blindingly fast that, you know, we're just going to do the whole thing in like 17 days. And because I really liked the experience on Hitting Hard and Soft. I shot a whole movie in 6 days. I'm like, what the fuck takes 4 years?
This sounds like a promising future. My people will be in touch with your people.
Okay.
We'll make something happen. James Cameron, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. Good talking to you. Thanks.
Give me a mountain with lots to do. Give me the sunshine. Give me a dew. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain dew. So give me my good friends. Give me a dew.
Grab some friends and an ice-cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew!
Okay, that was James Cameron. What a pleasure that was. And Billie Eilish, Hit Me Hard and Soft, the tour, live in 3D, is out now in cinemas across the country, nay, the world. And by a strange coincidence, one of Cameron's best friends, the great Guillermo del Toro, was also in town this week. And for a very good reason, the Mexican director was being honored with the BFI Fellowship. And rightly so, for Guillermo has, over the last 30 years or so, carved his name into filmic folklore as a truly visionary director, a man whose films are absolutely reflections of him and his personality and preoccupations in every single detail, from the visuals to the costumes to the themes. He is the director, of course, of the likes of Kronos, Blade 2, the two original and best Hellboy movies, Pan's Labyrinth, The Devil's Backbone, Pacific Rim, Crimson Peak, Nightmare Alley, and last year's Frankenstein, which saw the realization of a lifelong dream to adapt Mary Shelley's novel. He is also the guy, of course, who made The Shape of Water, a weird fantasy film about a fish man falling in love with a woman and, against all the odds, turned that into a Best Picture winner. He is, in my humble opinion, a genius and one of the best we've got, and this honour is in recognition of that. I've known Guillermo for over 20 years, and I always love chatting to him, but we've never actually done his origin story and a career play-by-play, which is what I intended to do with this interview when I sat down with him in a London hotel. In the end, we didn't quite go film by film, but what did happen was a fascinating insight into the man and the movie maker. Now, this was a long interview, around 45 minutes or so, and so this is an excerpt from that, the first 15 minutes, roughly. The rest will be up next week, but right now, I hope you enjoy this, because the latest BFI fellow was on cracking form. Enjoy. Guillermo del Toro, welcome to the Emperor Podcast.
How Who are you? What are you doing in my room? Get out.
I printed out my CV as laminated. I'm going to give it to you.
I'm calling the front desk.
Security. You were just a few hours away, sir, from becoming a BFI fellow.
Yes.
We're here in a lovely hotel room, a library at a hotel room. Yeah. Are you nervous at this point?
Well, you know, I did not know until today that I had to say something. I thought okay. I was going to just be, it was like a roast.
Yeah, now, I'm due on third.
Yeah.
I've got some singers.
Now that I know that I have, I'm starting to get a little nervous. I'm really, this is something you read about.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of those moments where those things that happen to other people are happening to you, and it's nice. Yeah. That's basically going to be my speech, which is when you are a kid, you read about that.
Yeah.
You read about, you know, Marcel Carnet and David Lean and, you know, all these John Hurt luminaries that are really guiding stars for you. Yeah.
An attaininess must have felt inconceivable to you when you were a kid growing up.
It does. I mean, especially because my relationship to British culture it goes all the way to my childhood. In a strange way, I am a child of the Haunted Moors.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, I belong to Oliver Twist. I belong to M.R. James. I belong to Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, and to the strange crossroads of Hammer films and Michael Powell and Press Burger. And, you know, there's so much of this culture that is exuberant in horror and in fantasy. That's funny. The English culture is all stiff upper lip except the fantastical side and or the murder side, you know, The seedy side is very
side as well.
The lurid side is very profound.
Yeah.
I think that is what makes it fascinating.
When was your first trip to England? Do you remember?
In the 80s.
Okay.
With my mother and my first wife. We came here and we stayed in the Churchill Hotel in London, and I went to the London Hospital trying to get a glimpse of the Elephant Man's skeleton.
Really?
Yeah, okay. I went to Whitechapel. Uh-huh. to do the
tour,
the river tour. I wanted to visit sort of the great haunted places, and we went to I wanted to visit the Arthur Conan Doyle's the Holmes house on the magicians. I wanted to go to the, which was a bit of a disappointment, the Magician's Club store.
Really?
And yeah, it was not as good as I thought it would be. I imagined a Hogwarts-like experience. It was a very bored man behind the counter.
Very much over it.
Like, yeah, well, very much over it. Yes, yeah. Like, oh, another one of these this type of guy coming in. Yeah.
And so, but even then, did you feel that connection? Did you feel magic in the soil?
Oh, no, absolutely. I thought. There's something in the soil, and London is such a crossroads of the pagan and the civilized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, pre-Roman times still vibrate under the soil. You know, the times of gods and goddesses that demanded blood is still here,
mm-hmm.
and it's a very particular city. It is both beautiful and haunting. You know, and I felt it. I felt every single strand. It resonated with me,
and
the bookstores, obviously,
of course, yeah.
You know, you can properly. I remember in that first trip, the first thing I wanted was a book by Dom Agustin Calmet about vampirism.
Okay,
and I found it. I found it the book. In a little used bookstore, and I had looked for it all my life, and I found it, and I bought it, and I couldn't afford it, but I could. I shouldn't have. I had to make great explanations for that. Yeah.
Do you still have that book? I imagine you do. Yeah.
I do, and it's still one of my biggest treasures.
So even now, when you're hitting the city, you hit the bookstores, the used bookstores.
Yeah, right now. I should exercise more caution, but there's one of my favorites is Jarndyce, which is across the street from the London Museum,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I try to go there. They know me well. I try to go there every time.
Do they set things aside for you, knowing you might like them? Okay,
they do. They said right now they have a really good selection of books waiting for me, and I'm very afraid.
Of the cost.
Because what you end up liking, when I came to London, I went to galleries that had Arthur Rackham's and Edmond Dulac's, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know, all the great illustrators of the golden age of gift books, and they're not, you know, people that collect this kind of things, they don't let them go cheap.
Yeah.
So it's a hobby I have indulged in for decades.
Do you get an Oscar winner discount now or a BFI fellow discount?
No, I don't think you can get, try it. There's no card. But I love it.
Oh my God.
I do love it.
Because you have always been a voracious consumer of all kinds of media.
Yeah.
I remember something you told me once about you would travel with a case full of DVDs and would dip in and out. I don't know whether you still do that.
No, now and my computer has over 7,000 movies.
Wow.
Yeah, and I have them I just call them up, and I do try to watch pieces of at least 3 movies a day if I can,
mm-hmm.
and a full movie certainly a day.
And what are you looking for?
You know, like I can, for example, I can be lulled into a certain rhythm of dialogue if I'm writing. You know, if you're writing a crisp contemporary thriller, you want to hear the patois of the friends of Eddie Coyle,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
But if you want to do, like, for me, the sort of Terence Rattigan rhythms of The Winslow Boy, the one with Robert Donat.
Yes.
Are really, really soothing into writing something like Frankenstein.
Okay.
Because the precision of the language is so beautiful.
So you don't, for example, exclude yourself from watching films when you're making another film?
No, but I try to make them visually not...
Similar.
Not similar.
Okay.
Like if I'm
There's
doing,
no overlap.
I'll give you an example. When I was doing Pacific Rim, I was watching Hoosiers with Gene Hackman. You know?
Okay.
Yeah, because for me, Pacific Rim was a sports movie.
Of course,
this old coach coming back to train a ragtag team of basketballers.
Of course, it was slap shot. Yes.
You know? Yes. Much more than anything else. And I'm not going to watch Bad Labor.
Yeah.
When I'm doing Pacific Rim or when I'm doing Crimson Peak, I was watching the Deakins adaptations that Lean did, you know, Oliver Twist or Great Expectations. Those were the interesting things for me.
Interesting. So, yeah, in Hoosiers, though, at no point does Gene Hackman hit someone with a battleship.
No.
So that doesn't...
No, but it was... I actually think there's a line that comes directly from Hoosiers. What were you doing all these years?
Oh, and he says,
and, you know, he has to say he was not coaching anyone. You know, and it's the same with Charlie Hunnam's character. Yeah.
That's amazing. Because on my way over here this morning, Guillermo, I was thinking that you and I have known each other now for over 20 years.
Incredible.
I know.
At least 60 pounds. How many stones have we met each other? Yeah.
And, you know, whenever we first met, I was a scrappy, promising young journalist.
Yeah.
And you were a filmmaker. It was on first Hellboy.
Yeah.
And you were a filmmaker very much on the up and up. Now, some 20 years later, I am just a journalist. I'm no longer promising because I'm too jaded and cynical.
A jaded man.
You are an Oscar winner, a visionary director, regarded as one of the best in the world, and now a BFI fellow. So I'm asking you, Guillermo, what went wrong for me?
Nothing. I think you're still my role model. You're still my role model.
You look at me and go, whatever he does, do the opposite.
I want to do that.
But on the way over, we've talked so often over the years about so many projects that you've made, but we've never done the origin story.
No.
We've never really sat down and talked about that before. What is the Guillermo del Toro origin story that you off the path
I think why I was interested in being who I am since I was in the crib. I mean, my earliest memories are of being sort of odd.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was a recording from when I was barely 2 or 3 years old. My father recorded me asking for a mandrake root to do a witchcraft ritual. I was really, really, when I was less than six or around six, I wanted to be in a contest on TV, Life and Times, with it was called the $24,000 questions or something, and people came in that were specialized on a theme, and I said I want to participate with the Life and Times of Christopher Lee.
What the hell?
I always was very odd, and I always wanted to have my own sort of monster house.
Yeah.
I had a room in my grandma's house that said, do not enter Monster Club. And I was very, very little. And now I have a couple of houses full of my memorabilia. And I go there and every morning I feel I am that kid.
Even back then, you were talking about the book on vampirism that you wanted to buy when you came to London. Is there something that when you were 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old that you wanted to attain that you have attained since then?
Everything. I mean, I wanted a room where it rained all day. I made that. I wanted a secret bookshelf, a passage. I built one. I wanted a house basically with no windows and all bookshelves. I have one, you know, and... I really wanted to tell these stories that were a crossroads between fairy tales and horror.
Yeah.
Or bring gothic to sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that all that has become true. Whatever that spirit was, has remained intact because I've never made a movie for any ulterior motives, than just I adore it and I love it and I want to do it. The closest I came to that was Blade 2.
Yeah.
But I went to Wesley and I said, look, I want you to understand, I don't understand Blade.
Yeah.
I'm on the side of the bad guy.
Yes, yes.
I'm on the side of Nomak.
Yeah.
Because he's Frankenstein for me. Yes. It's the story of the Frankenstein creature. I said, is it okay if I deal with him? And Wesley is so cool that I said, you deal with Blade. And that's how we did it.
Wow.
I dealt with the fight scenes. I choreographed that with the best teams I could possibly get together. But what makes Blade tick, I did not understand. Like Wesley always would say, I want him to be one step ahead of everybody. I go, okay, that sounds good. You know, he DJs at night. I am absolutely impaired for rhythms and music. You know, like I, under a certain light effect, it may look like I'm moving, but I'm mostly mostly immovable.
And have you come close since to understanding Blade's viewpoint?
No, I don't understand.
It's still something you can't quite connect
it's
with.
It's like there's a reason. I've been offered the biggest superheroes.
Yeah.
Over and over again, and I only understand the weird ones.
Yeah,
I understand Hellboy. I understand Deadman.
Yeah.
I understand Jack Kirby's Demon.
Yeah,
Swamp Thing.
Yeah,
but I don't understand the big guys.
Did you come close to Fantastic Four at any point? Was that
no,
something I read?
I came
once?
Close to other ones that I'm on their NDAs not to reveal.
Okay.
But I came close to other ones. Fantastic Four is something that I think is the best thing for me is that cover with the Mole Man and the monster coming out of the pavement.
Yeah, it's all downhill from there.
It's all for me. That's the encapsulation of what makes that attractive, and of course, it's the Kennedy era, hopeful America.
Yeah.
But no, I was not a Marvel guy. I was more of a DC guy.
Okay.
Yeah. Very much so.
That's very much more, DC, I think, is much more gods and monsters, which seems to be very much.
DC is much more into the dark side.
Yeah.
Like, to me, the best thing for Jack Kirby was when he went into the weird creature, pure, like obviously Monsters Unleashed and all that. But the Demon or Commandy.
Yeah.
Commandy, I absolutely love it. And Kirby was for me the best when he was doing the outsized, the new gods.
Yeah.
The big mythologies.
This is stuff you're growing up reading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and I think Kirby is one of the great storytellers of American history.
Go and get ready to become a BFI fellow.
Call me sir.
Hail BFI fellow. Well met.
Thank you, man.
Cheers, man. There you go. That was Guillermo del Toro, the latest BFI fellow. Congratulations to him on a truly incredible achievement. Okay, shall we have one more legend? Why not? Remarkably Bright Creatures is a new film that hits Netflix May 8th. Directed by Olivia Newman and based on the novel by Shelby Van Pelt, it stars Sally Field as Tova, a cleaning woman who forms two unlikely bonds. First, with a super smart octopus called Marcellus, who lives in the aquarium where she works and who narrates the film, with voice provided by Alfred Molina. And then, with a stranger in town, Cameron, played by Lewis Pullman. Yes, that's right, folks. It's the century and Aunt May together at last. Oh, and also with Doc Ock in the mix. Field, of course, is a legendary two-time Best Actress Oscar winner and the star of countless classic movies from Norma Rae and Places in the Heart to Absence of Malice, Forrest Gump, Mrs. Doubtfire, Lincoln. Lewis Pullman is a young, very much on the up actor, but you'll know him, of course, not just as Bob in Thunderbolts, but also the likes of Salem's Lot, The Testament of Anne Lee, and more. I spoke to them last week on Zoom about this really sweet movie about working with invisible octopi, finding common ground as actors and characters, and the time that Sally Field worked with Lewis's dad, Bill. Had a blast. Enjoy. Sally, Lewis, welcome to the Emperor Podcast.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
I believe that you finished shooting this movie about a year ago. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So junkets like this must be great because you say goodbye to each other a year ago and then you get brought together again for this. Have you been catching up all day long? Is that how it works?
We're kind of doing it on the go a little bit. Well, we did come together from at another point earlier on to do other press stuff, and yeah. You know, the press stuff brings you together, which is always good.
Yeah, it's good, and it's good kind of like a means to recollect some of the stories that we're having to draw out of the old Rolodex like a year ago.
But to make sure you're on the same page and you're not just telling wildly different stories.
Yeah. Okay. Was there an octopus? Wasn't there an octopus?
I don't know. Did you see one?
You know.
How well did you see it? Do you dream about him now? Is he somewhere in your dreams?
Well, that's the do you? Does this Marcellus stay with you after you've left the film?
A version of him does. We had to talk about him yesterday, and I have to say last night I thought about him a lot. So he was in my I'm not so sure it was a dream. I don't know if it was, it's that part of dreaming that is this awake or is this a dream, but he was there. Marcellus, he has been a big part of my life for many years, because I read the book in galleys, so early on I got to be part of the process of adapting this lovely book to film. So he's been in my life a long time, and I kind of miss him.
Lewis, what about yourself?
Well, I don't know. I was kind of thinking about who Marcellus is for Tova and versus who he is for Cameron.
Yeah,
very different. And I almost feel like, and this might be very wrong because I'm just kind of arriving here, but like I almost feel like Tova is Cameron's Marcellus, like this. This kind of catalyst. Because they're both stuck, mm-hmm. or they're in this kind of liminal.
They're lost.
Yes. And I don't know how much Marcellus helps Cameron kind of through Tova, I would say.
Well, he helps Cameron a little bit with his dating problems.
That's right.
But then Tova comes in and settles it.
Yeah, you really, it really did.
Let's pull back the curtain a little bit on how you interacted with Marcellus. What were you interacting with?
We're now trying to figure out amongst ourselves how much we want to reveal of the magic. Was he there? Was there really an octopus? How much was there an octopus? Mm-hmm. Or how much was really just our imagination and then the brilliance of our special effects team? So that's kind of the answer.
Interesting.
I will say, kind of thinking about it now, there still is a lot of magic for me, because on the day I did not understand what was happening. You know,
I remember that, especially that day where the first day that Tova comes in and he's out of his tank, and Cameron is freaking out.
Yes,
and you as Lewis kept saying, "I don't know what we're looking at. I don't know what we're doing. I don't know what we're doing." I would say, just follow me.
And that ended up being the best compass, was like, because there was so much unknown, I don't know anything. You know, it was an army that kind of made this whole thing happen. Yeah,
but in reality, that's exactly what Cameron was doing. Yeah. There was an octopus out of the tank and he's freaking out, going, "I don't know how to do this. I don't know I don't know what's happening." And it's Tova saying, "Get the books, get the thing, open them." So that's kind of was our working existence.
Lewis, of course, you've got, you know, your MCU experience to bring to bear, I guess, on reacting and acting with things that aren't necessarily there. Although Thunderbolts was a little bit more practical in that sense, I guess, right?
Thunderbolts was definitely more practical. Jake Schreier really was intent on that, which was awesome. I feel like every movie I do, there's some kind of stretching and kind of extending yourself to kind of build the world within your mind. This was fun, though, because like that scene in particular where Marcellus is out of the tank, the whole set is practical, even though it was a beautiful, like that was the kind of engine room of the aquarium. Yeah. And all that was real in there. All the shelves and stuff that was falling.
The tank was real. Everything
was real.
There
were dudes hiding in the corners with fishing wire, you know, pulling boxes off the shelf as Marcellus kind of scampered through. So when the world is reacting around it and you're reacting around it, your brain pretty much does the job in filling in the blanks for you.
Or should.
Yeah. Should, hopefully.
Yeah. There's a famous story on Who Framed Roger Rabbit, that Bob Hoskins was interacting every single day for months on end with a creature that wasn't there, Roger Rabbit. And yeah. He began to eventually hallucinate. He could see Roger in real life.
Yeah.
Has that happened to you? Is Marcellus in the room?
I completely get that. Yeah. How much work I did with Marcellus, and especially the end sequence, which we won't give it away, no. Of what happens. But I mean, I could feel him. I could feel the weight of him and the pull of him. And absolutely. But you know what? Acting, if you're really doing what you're supposed to do, really is hallucinating, isn't
right.
it?
Right. Yeah.
It is hallucinating.
Self-inflicted.
Yeah.
Hallucination.
It's you hypnotize yourself, self-hypnosis, and you think something is that isn't really happening. But as far as you're concerned, it is happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure Jimmy Stewart took Harvey around with him everywhere.
Right? I bet he did. Yeah.
Are your approaches to acting simpatico in a way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was no slip between cup and lip, as they say, or there was no guardrail that needed to come up. It just was bam, you know.
Yeah.
There was a lot of improvisation, which was great, yeah. Great, great fun. He was Cameron. We just belonged together, you know, from the crabbiness of Tova yelling at him.
Yeah.
Till the end, you know, sometimes when he's furious at her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I'd say it's a good sign when you're like on set and you're like, it's not like you want to just do the scene to get it over with. You're like, you just are in constant anticipation of like, just I want to do it because that's the playtime. And yeah. It's like so fun.
Especially at the end when we really didn't know where we were yeah. going, you know. And it was pouring down rain in beautiful, magnificent Vancouver
yeah.
and really, really cold. It was about 34 degrees and we were soaking wet.
You were out there a lot longer.
I was soaking wet. He was in the heated room waiting to come on.
How unfair and backwards is that?
Sally, that's not, yeah, that shouldn't be allowed, quite frankly.
No, yeah. It shouldn't
yeah.
be.
Yeah. So tell me about the improvisation as well, because there is such a beautiful, I guess, improvisational quality to this relationship between Cameron and Tova, who are at least two lost souls who are kind of finding each other. Mm-hmm. Was that something that Olivia was encouraging from the off, that you would improvise, you would play with scenes?
I think she realized she better just sit down and be quiet. Because there wasn't any, that's what we were doing. And it, you know, sometimes you have to allow and you have to watch to see what actors are doing and give them this space to just sit back and watch what's happening. And since from the first time we met, we started doing that, just
yeah.
playing and answering back and talking and saying things that weren't on the page. To me, that's the fun thing of doing anything creative, because it isn't what I think or Livy thinks or Lewis thinks or anybody, any writer. It is together, something happens that could not have been anticipated. Don't
yeah,
you think?
Definitely. And I also think one of the great gifts of adapting a book, obviously it's really challenging because you're competing with the audience's imaginations yeah. and their own personalized worlds that they built, but we had a whole roadmap, and Sally in particular should have seen this incredible scroll that she would carry around with her, a huge binder of and so like point being like, yes, it was improv, but it was all very based in,
it was rooted in the story
yes.
telling that was I had mapped out using the book as the guideline.
Yes.
And many times because I was so focused on it in that way, I didn't have to focus on the whole film or what lenses we were using, or I could pinpoint, wait a minute, if this happens and that happens, we have, that has to happen there. And so you needed it's kind of a very small, but very complicated story. Mm. So I just, probably many times was a pain in everybody's behind because I was like, wait a minute. We got to, this has to happen. They can't do that. So
thank God. I think there would have been some missing holes in there.
Oh, I don't know.
No, oftentimes that when that binder came out, there was, we were like, wait, we didn't think about that.
I'm fascinated by
page
this binder.
37, it says.
It's a beautiful artifact.
What was it? What was the binder exactly, Sally? Was it the book and then you had annotated it?
No. I had worked on it for so long and it got to be part of the process of really adapting it because I was the first person involved in the project that the producers had brought it to me. I just had, you know, I had written out, I had sort of like an outline of the story, but I'm bringing in pieces of the book to inform this piece and that piece. So we had to play it this way because that piece has to inform this piece. And it was complicated.
I need to see that binder. That binder needs to be published.
Yeah,
really?
Absolutely. I've got to let you guys go in a second, but you talked there about how you've interacted and how you've been with each other since you first met. When did you first meet? Because obviously, Sally, you have worked with Bill Pullman on stage. So I don't know, Lewis, if you went to see that production of All My Sons or if that's where you first met, perhaps.
I did. And I won't be able to live this one down, but I didn't go backstage and meet Sally after the fact.
But there was no backstage, really. Not at the old Vic.
Yeah.
We went up to that cafe. Everybody went up to that up above and up the stairs and towards the back.
Ingle.
And because I rarely went there, because being the hermit that I am, I would just go home.
I don't blame you. After a play like that, this play was remarkable. It was a true feat. I mean, and also, like I was saying last night, like when you see there's something, you know, obviously a good movie can kind of leave you speechless for a while, but like a play where you are sharing the same oxygen as the actors up there and the illusion is really kind of, there's something that kind of reaches your bloodstream on a molecular level like that. I was shaken up by that for quite some time. And in some ways, like, allowed me to be able to like have that, my idea of you as like that was that performance isolated. And then when I met you to do the reading in this, it was like different. It was like not Sally from All My Sons. It was this is Toba
all together.
Yeah, which was great.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you both. Sally, Lewis, thanks for your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Sally Field and Lewis Pullman, and Remarkably Bright Creatures is out from Friday, May 8th on Netflix. And that is it. From me right now, thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.
The Sleep Outfitters Memorial Day Sale is on, and you can save up to $1,500 store-wide. For a limited time, save up to $500 on adjustable sets from Tempur-Pedic and Sealy. Or get a purple king mattress for the price of a queen. Plus, enjoy free next day delivery and setup. And our exclusive lifetime price guarantee means you always get the best deal. Don't miss the Sleep Outfitters Memorial Day Sale. Going on now. Save up to $1,500 store-wide. Only at Sleep Outfitters.
With lots to do, give me the sunshine, give me a do, give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing Mountain Dew. So give me my good friends, give me a do.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.